Session number 16632, Titty Heart Moxon, Reel 5, followed after a short pause by Reel 6. Left channel, informant's mic only, right channel, informant and interviewer's mic.
Yes, I was talking about Mengele. Now, Mengele got, he was only one of the many SS doctors that we had. Many of them carried out surgical operations, and they were particularly interested in research into sterilization because they wanted to sterilize all the Jewish women, and they castrated the men. They experimented with castrating the men. The other thing, there was one doctor that, for instance, wanted to know the effect of malnutrition, I believe, on the liver. And so in order to do that, he would pick up prisoners who were so emaciated that, you know, they were not going to survive. And he used to have them on a slab, and he would tell them that he would examine them and they have to have an injection. Well, in fact, they had a phenol injection into the heart, and he used to kill them off, open them up, because he had to have a hot liver to practice on. Yes, because this was the only research he could do. He had to be immediately post-mortem. So there were some ghastly experiments, but what I really wanted to say is the whole machinery of death was conducted by doctors, which is, I think, completely unbelievable. You see, it's the doctors who determined who was going to live and die. It was the doctors who would determine how much gas is to be used to kill a certain number of people. They'd work it out, because nobody else could work it out. So when so the whole machinery of death was in the hands of the doctors, not just the experiments. You see, the selections were mostly carried out by doctors, and this is why Mengele would carry out the selections also in the hospital. They would work out how much room is there in this camp and how many people can be disposed of, because we've got new ones to come in, and he'd work this out, and so many have to die and so many will be brought in and so many are allowed to live, and here comes a transport of 10,000 people, we must kill off perhaps 8,000 and let 2,000 in. That was the kind of mathematics that went on, and those were the doctors who made these decisions.
You of course were examined by him, weren't you, on that occasion? What sort of impression did you get of him? You know, what did he look like?
Oh, he looked absolutely ghastly, I tell you. I've got a photograph of him. He had the most piercing black eyes. That's all I remember. Very dark hair and dark eyes. I've actually got a picture of him here as a young man, so I can show it to you. Yeah, I've got a picture of him. I saw him many times, Mengele, because when I tell you more, I eventually worked in the hospital. So I have seen most of these SS doctors at work. I was once caught by one of them, a Dr. Ode. I was, I think it was at the time when I went to try and see my mother, and they were rounding up a barrack, and I couldn't get away fast enough, and I was caught in this roundup. But fortunately, they only wanted blood. So they took us all into a hut, and they sucked out an awful lot of blood. And we were told this is blood for the soldiers fighting on the Russian front. And I thought, well, that's ironic, you know, the Jewish blood's good enough for that, but that's all it's good for. that's for the Dr. Rode. So I have encountered quite a few of the Nazi doctors there, Dr. Koenig and Rode and Kramer and kind of them. But as I said, Mengele, I was through his selection, so I can tell you best about him. He was always immaculately dressed, white gloves. They all wore gloves, you see, all these people, all the SS coming into the camp always wore white gloves because they were afraid of contamination, and because the lice were, you know, the cause of typhus. And of course, they had typhus also in the SS barracks at that time, because they were not immune to that. So they were very much afraid and of any contact. So there was never any contact with Assange.
Yes, it's interesting. Yes. These sort of inconsistencies, you know, as you were saying about the blood, and you know, from your description of the camp, it sounds so un-Teutonic somehow. Well, one associates Germans with cleanliness and orderliness.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because in the hut itself, you'd have descriptions on the top. You know, the sort of wooden planks holding up the structure, and it was all printed on. Cleanliness next to godliness. You know, you've got to keep clean, but of course you didn't have any water, and you didn't have any clothes. You know, it was just a kind of cynical. Everything was done to dehumanize you, and for you to give up. In fact,
do you think that?
Oh yes, I think yes. There was no doubt about it that there was a pressure, or there was. You know, you're brainwashed into thinking that you might as well give up, because there's no other way. We're going to break you sooner or later. If we don't break you physically, we break you mentally. And of course, some people gave up mentally. The physical disintegration followed immediately. You could tell when people started to give up. At first, they would. Yeah, people would have this kind of vacant look in their eyes, and they stopped trying to look after themselves. You know, you were fighting for water or whatever, but once you began to give up, you were no longer prepared to fight. You just didn't care anymore. And you could tell by just looking at people that they were on the point of giving up. And eventually, of course, they began to, you know, to starve and... The name for these people were the Muslims. And as soon as you became a Muslim, and of course you were very much afraid of yourself becoming a Muslim, so you tried not to associate with people or go near them when you knew, oh dear, this person looks as though he's on the way out. And of course, if you mixed with pessimists, it was another thing. You had to keep away from people who said, well, you know, I might as well die, I'm going on the fence, I'm going to commit suicide. You had to keep away from people like this, because it's terribly contagious.
Were there many suicides that you witnessed?
There were some, but not as many as I would have thought. Not as many. Mostly people died of shock, of sheer starvation, of weakness. Weakness, mostly. People just became weak. And the thing is this, if you are starved, you can no longer think. This is really what happens. It does something to your brain immediately. You know, you become disorientated. You can't even think of a suicide because you can no longer think clearly. And this was a place where you had to have your wits about you the whole of the time. You couldn't afford not to think. And another thing that contributed to this, we think, was what my mother used to say there. The soup that they distributed contained an additive. What exactly it was, we didn't know. We thought it was a bromide or something. After the war, I found out it was a substance called AVO. But I don't think anyone's AVO, I think. I don't think ever that any research had been done what it was. I know there was some white powder added to the soup, because I knew people who worked in the kitchens and they were being supervised of putting this powder into the soup. And my mother used to say that she couldn't eat a lot of the soup because her mind used to start to wander. She said, I can't think clearly when I have a lot of soup. And we couldn't understand what really that meant. But I could never eat that camp soup. It just made me vomit just to look at it. And so I never suffered from that. I preferred to live on just dry bread and potatoes or onions, if you could get them. You know, people were digging outside and working in the fields were bringing in carrots and onions, and that's the sort of thing I lived on, which, unknown to me, was probably not such a bad diet after all. What little of it there was, you know. Certainly wasn't any protein, no milk, no nothing else, no fats, nothing like that. But I resisted from eating camp soup from the very start.
Had you started your periods when you went into Auschwitz?
Well, I started my periods while I was in Germany, funny enough. But it abruptly stopped when I was actually in prison. So I don't know whether it was sort of psychologically something happened. And I never had it again. I didn't have it in Auschwitz at all. And no one had it in Auschwitz. I think, of course, if you start and malnutrition, body function doesn't go on, I think, when you are on a starvation diet. No, I didn't have it until after the war, after that. Thankfully, because I don't know, it's something you couldn't cope with. It was almost impossible.
Also, on this sort of theme, were there sexual relations? I'm not thinking of your own case, but one hears, for instance, of babies being born in.
Well, of course, the babies that were born in Auschwitz were pregnant women that got into the camp, that were not noticed that they were pregnant during the selection into the camp. Of course, when they were pregnant and they gave birth, their babies had to be killed. Oh, mostly they were stillborn ones. But if they were not killed immediately, then of course the women themselves were taken to be killed. So they were urged to try and kill their babies or give them away immediately or even not let on that they'd had a baby. Now, as far as sex is concerned, because we must realise men were separated from women, there was no contact, and if there was contact, it was illegal contact. And if there was any contact at all, it was between the ruling prisoners. For instance, I always felt the men fared better than the women in Auschwitz. Maybe I'll just say a little bit about that. First of all, the women's enclosure was smaller than the men's, and it was very much more overcrowded. So conditions immediately were, much, much worse. The other thing is, men who came into the camp were in a completely different situation to women. Women were teenage girls, mostly. All right, some might have been 20, 22. They didn't have any occupation. Mostly they were schoolgirls. Well, you might have had one or two nurses, you might have had one or two doctors who were mature women. But by and large, there were teenage girls who had no occupation. Now you take the men. Men who came into the camp, 18, 20-year-olds, 25-year-olds, carpenters, there were locksmiths, there were pharmacists, some were doctors. They had all kinds of skills that the women didn't have, so they were naturally in a much better situation. They could get into better work positions. They, of course, when they were locksmiths, they were, taken to, the tailors, for instance, who were working for the Germans, you see, were making uniforms, so they were in a better situation. So I always felt that the men must have fared better, although I don't go on anything, they survived better than the women, but they had a far better chance of survival. Women, all the teenage girls could do manual labour. That's all they were good for, you see. And the few skills that they had, there were one or two that could play in an orchestra, and they, of course, as you know, we had a camp orchestra, but by and large, the men fared better. Now, when you had men carpenters, they came in groups into the women's camp to do repairs or on some pretext that they had to come to the women's camp. But what in fact happened is they managed to make contact with some women, and mostly with only women who were in a better situation than the ordinary prisoners, the lowest form of prisoner. They make contact with people, have better occupations, they look more presentable, and then maybe you had contact. Whether it got as far as actually having sex, I don't think that is. In Birkenau, very unlikely. Perhaps in Auschwitz one. In Birkenau, the only people that were in that situation could have been the women in charge of a block, because they had a little room to themselves, so maybe they could entertain a carpenter or somebody like that, and maybe then you did have something like that. There was an awful lot of illegal letter writing, which was totally forbidden. That went on in that sense, but whether there were actually any sex acts, I doubt it. And as far as things like homosexuality, I didn't know something like that existed. I had no idea. I mean, I must have been really, you know, raw. I didn't know anything about sexuality until perhaps a few years back here, when all the sexuality, the homosexuality came to the fore. You know, it never even occurred to me. And as far as lesbians were concerned, well, I couldn't believe there was such a thing as lesbians. What happened in the camp is women looked after each other. The women did. You had older women with younger women, but they didn't. Nobody ever thought about sex. The only, when they talk about sex, I think the only thing, yeah, I've never actually seen this, but I believe there was a brothel. A brothel, that's right. There was a sort of a brothel in Auschwitz I, I believe. But first of all, there were never any Jewish prisoners, because of course they were not allowed to have relations with the Germans anyway. I think there were. They also had prostitutes there, you know, German prostitutes that had been convicted, because I think it was illegal in Germany at the time. So they had German prostitutes there, and they also had some Polish prostitutes. So I think they had a sort of a brothel for the ruling prisoners, male ruling prisoners, and for the male SS. But in Birkenau, I don't recall any sex at all. But you know, that must have been the most farthest thing removed from your mind, thinking about sex. If you could think of sleep, a lavatory, you know, to relieve yourself, and food, those are the only things that really mattered. And if you could achieve these three things, you could get by. Everything else was immaterial. As long as you had something enough to keep you warm, you didn't care what you looked like, as long as you were dressed. What was very important was to have a good pair of shoes, boots, and that was a very difficult thing. Because if you did have a pair of boots, you couldn't actually take them off. In fact, you couldn't take your clothes off, because if you took them off, you see, you might have never seen them again. So anything you possessed, well, you wore. If you had two bread rations, you had them tucked underneath your arm. If you had a bowl and a spoon, you had it tied to your waist, because you couldn't put anything down. So this is a very difficult thing for people to understand today, that you actually lived, but you had nothing other than what you actually wore, and there's nothing you could put down anywhere that was yours, because you might have never found it again.
You mentioned music.
Yes.
Did you have music?
Oh, well, that's very, very strange about music in Auschwitz. We had what was known as the main gate. So not the main gate where that you see on the pictures, but a gate between the bee enclosure, women's bee enclosure, and where women used to go out to work. There was a small hut, a wooden hut, and on this platform the SS would stand and sort of take the salute, as you were, you know. They would stand there watching the work parties go out and come in. I don't know whether they were actually counting them. I think they're probably counting the number of work parties going out and the number coming back. But next to this was another platform, and there was an orchestra. Now, what happened was that people were actually drummed out to work. And they were playing marches to march people out and march them back. And very often they had to sing. The prisoners actually had to sing, going out to work and coming back in. And the type of music they were playing was usually laid down what they had to play, certain German marches. What they did, they when transports would arrive, of course, there were some musicians, or there were girls that could play instruments, they would ask anyone play an instrument, and then they would form this orchestra. The woman who conducted the orchestra was actually the niece of Gustav Mahler, the composer. I believe Mahler himself was Jewish, but her name was Alma Rose. She wasn't actually, she was known as a Mischling, she was only part Jewish. I don't know whether she had a Jewish, she must have had a Jewish mother to be part Jewish, I think. I don't know. Anyway, she was only part Jewish. And she was a musician, and she was made to be the conductor. And these girls were given a hut, and they had a privileged position, of course. They had better food and better clothes. And she ruled this orchestra with an iron fist. She used to beat them up. Well, she had to, I presume, because they had to play the music well, because perhaps some of them couldn't actually do so. And they also gave concerts to the SS. They were taken to give these concerts. And sometimes they would actually give concerts in Birkenau on a Sunday, but the concerts would coincide with a punishment. In other words, the whole enclosure was punished for some misdemeanor. You could never tell what it was, you know. There was collective punishment, so if somebody was caught doing something, the whole, perhaps 1,000 prisoners were punished. And I remember an occasion on a Sunday, those Sundays the work parties didn't go out. They announced that Okita was going to give a concert, but everybody was going to do sport, and the sport meant there was a punishment. We were all kneeling in the mud with our arms up in the air, and then we had to jump and perform sort of certain sport while the orchestra was playing. So that was the orchestra. Now, they had a comparable orchestra in the male enclosure, I believe, where they had some quite famous musicians, because, you know, when they brought people up from all over Europe, they had quite famous people in this orchestra. Now, perhaps I just tell you something about Alma Rosé herself. My mother knew her very well, because she had typhus, and she was brought onto the typhus block. My mother looked after her, and she became quite friendly with her. Apparently, they were actually going to release her as a special sort of, you know, she was this special person. They wanted her. She was such a good conductor, they actually wanted her out of the camp, I believe. So she was going to be released, although she was only part Jewish. Now, the ruling prisoners in this camp got to know about this release. Of course, they were terribly jealous, because many of them were actually condemned to death there. You know, some of the older couples and the Lager Ältestes and whoever they were. But they invited her, these ruling prisoners, to a farewell feast, apparently. I mean, I wasn't there, but this is what the prisoners were said. And when she was there, they poisoned her. I mean, they definitely killed her, because she was brought back to my mother's block then. I mean, she was already there, she died. Yes. And she was given a proper funeral by the SS. That was the only person that I was ever given a funeral. Yes. That was the story of Alma Rosé. I don't know any more about it. I know that there has been some people have researched her background. But I know she was Gustav Mahler's niece. I didn't know anyone in the orchestra myself. But of course we've got, there is somebody in London, isn't it? I think another occasion I recall, I did not explain that after I had typhus, I managed to persuade the woman in charge there of the block to allow me to stay, to work there. Because, you see, I would have been thrown back out onto the main heap, the main camp, and I would have started all from scratch. And, of course, the friends that I had, they might have been gone, and everything had to be started from scratch. And so it was very important for me to, and I couldn't regain my strength at that point. And so it was really essential that I should have been allowed to stay to work there. And eventually my mother and I persuaded these people, this woman there, to let me stay. And I stayed and became what was known as a cleaner, putzerin, putzerka, which basically meant carrying out the bodies, which was very hard work. And we had a death toll of about 300 a day, I think, at that stage. And I worked on the Durchfall block, that's a diarrhea block, so you can imagine, dysentery block, in fact, it was. While I was on the dysentery block, going back to talking about the orchestra, Mengele used to come in and say, all convalescents ought to go out into the sunshine today, because it's a fine day, and we'll get the orchestra to play. And then, sort of the next day, you'd come, the whole block has got to be emptied, and then they all got to die because we've got new people coming in. They've all got to be selected today. That was the paradox, you see. At 1 minute, the sick had to be, because they were already convalescent, they had to go into the sunshine, and the next day, there was a selection, and they were all gone. And what I really want to tell you at this point, that I worked in this hospital block, I think it was number 12. It was adjoining the ramp, you know, the platform where people were coming in out of the trucks. And I did want to tell you that every time a transport came and people were unloaded, sometimes the sick, or shall we say the elderly, couldn't walk. They would take them on to lorries, to the crematoria. But at the back of every convoy, there would be a Red Cross ambulance. But what people didn't realise, that in there was the gas precisely measured out to kill these very people. It was always, when we saw the Red Cross ambulance, we knew this was the end of the transport. They'd all been taken away. And we could see that from the block where I was. And that was the transports would arrive day and night. I'm now speaking about March, April 1944. And one day, what happened there was Mengele came in and he said, the whole block, that was my block where I was, has to be emptied because we have got a lot of sick people in the camp and they've all got to come in. And the woman in charge of the blockade today went to she said, we have got a lot of convalescents here, you know, they've only had dysentery, they're all well, they're ready to go back to the camp. No, he said, they all got to go, and we have to sort of stand and ring this block. And at that stage, I lost some of my best friends because they were on my block, and you know, I was hiding them there as well at the time because they were already convalescent, they were not quite well enough to be thrown back back into the camp. But we knew it was very dangerous to be in the hospital, and we couldn't save any of them. And that day, the whole block was empty, and we lost all our. I lost most of my friends, some that had been with me in Germany, you know, and they were already convalescent. They'd been through typhus and they'd had dysentery, and at that point we lost them all. And then this block was totally emptied, and they sealed it up. They didn't actually bring anybody in. And the very next thing, they came and announced, oh, we're going to disinfect this block, but not yet. However, all the staff, well, there wasn't all, because I was already working there on the staff, we are forming a new work group called the Canada Commando. And anyone that wants to join this commando, you can go and work there. You'll have everything there. So we didn't realise what it meant. We did know there was a Canada commando in Auschwitz I, but these girls were always separated, and we've never had any contact with them, so we didn't quite know what it meant. But my mother said, you must go, because it didn't matter what there is. As long as there's food there, you must go, because I just couldn't recover my strength. And I volunteered, actually, to go with all the others. Everybody decided, you know, we must go. If there's going to be, if there's only food for 2 or 3 days, we must go. And so they took us all, and that is how I came to the Canada section of Birkenau. And perhaps we'll talk about this.
When you were talking a little earlier about the clearing of the hospital that time, the section you were in, and your friends were taken away, you know, I wonder how that affected you.
Well, I think at that point, when I had to actually help my friends onto the lorries, onto the all the screams and shouts all around, and people are begging for help, and I just wanted to go onto the lorries as well. And in fact, I was very near the lorry and being loaded on with these people, and suddenly from nowhere my mother appeared, and she just grabbed me and pulled me away. And at that point I just didn't want to live, because I felt I'd just been through typhus, and I wasn't all that well, and I was on the verge of giving up, and I just saw my friends you know, being taken away and knowing very well what was going to happen to him. I just wanted to go with him.
That was your lowest point?
That was my lowest point, yes, at that point.